Welcome to the SermonCoach.com podcast. I'm your host, Dean Wilson. We're talking today with Dr. David Maines, the executive director of SermonCoach.com. It's our desire to help pastors create effective, life-transforming sermons. In today's podcast, we continue to illustrate how to use the Sermon Coach method for developing life-transforming sermons. Step 1. A minister using this method begins by choosing a subject for his or her sermon. Step 2. Choose what response he or she desires from the congregation. Step 3. Provide some how-tos that will clearly and concisely point the congregation to the desired response. Step 4. Either explicitly or implicitly suggest some reasonable time frame or how long it will take before the congregation begins to realize the value that will come from their response. Step 5. Construct a single sentence that sums up the subject and response. Such a sentence will give the congregation a memory hook to help them remember the substance of a given sermon. As one who preaches, you can use the Sermon Coach method to develop every individual sermon that you preach. You can also use it to develop an entire series of messages. For example, in today's podcast, we're sharing another in a series of messages that Dr. David Maines wrote for his Chapel of the Air radio broadcast nearly 30 years ago. Each of these broadcasts centers on the book of Isaiah. The complete series consists of 19 sermons, including 4 dramatic presentations. Using the concepts illustrated by this series, a minister could begin a similar series in September and preach all through the fall months, culminating in Advent. David, we invite you to continue to coach us by sharing this message.
Have you had the experience of being taken on a guided tour at a museum or art gallery and strongly suspecting that the person in charge really knows nothing more about the subject at hand other than his memorized spiel? Well, you might feel this way about me in a minute or so if I tried to bluff my way through what's ahead. See, in our study of Isaiah the prophet, I've been putting off talking about the book as it relates to the matter of great literature. I'm kind of torn. One, because I don't know that much about the subject, but two, I feel I really ought to say something because all the commentators write things like, Isaiah had no superior, not even a rival for versatility of expression and brilliancy of imagery. That's from the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia. Reading further, epigrams and metaphors, interrogation and dialogue, antithesis and alliteration, hyperbole and parable, even paronomasia, characterize Isaiah's book as the masterpiece of Hebrew literature. How's that strike you? Impressive, huh? Let me admit, at the outset, to my lack of qualifications in judging the accuracy of such words, but at the same time underscore that it's not fair because of that to just dismiss this area. I considered asking an expert to join me, but decided not to when I even had trouble coming up with good questions. And it was at this point I decided that most of you are probably where I am anyway, therefore why not keep what I share on a very primary level? For example, I'm aware that Old Testament poetry is unlike what one expects when first hearing that term. We think of a poem as something that includes rhyme, but rhyme and meter, or a determined measured beat, play no part in ancient Hebrew poetry. More important to them was parallelism, or repeating the same idea only with different words. Here's an example from Isaiah chapter 1. Now listen closely. The ox knows its owner. Now the idea is repeated. And the ass, its master's crib. But Israel does not know, or said over again, my people does not understand. Ah, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity. That's saying the same thing. Ah, sinful nation, next, a people laden with iniquity. Get the pattern? Offspring of evildoers. Said a different way, next line. Sons who deal corruptly. They have forsaken the Lord. They have despised the Holy One of Israel. You see what I'm pointing out? Look at chapter 1 of Isaiah closely, and what I'm explaining should be obvious to you. And if it is, consider yourself to have mastered Hebrew literature, lesson 1. The second illustration of literary style in the writings of Isaiah is the use of song. That's easy enough. In the background, you're hearing the Jews for Jesus group singing a verse from Isaiah 12. Behold, God is my salvation. I will trust and will not be afraid. For the Lord God is my strength and my song, and he has become my salvation.
He also has become my salvation. For the Lord my God is my strength and my song. He also has become my salvation.
Such an adaptation is appropriate because Isaiah 12 is a lyric poem or poetry meant to be sung. Another such example would be chapter 26, which begins, "In that day this song will be sung in the land of Judah. We have a strong city. He sets up salvation as walls and bulwarks. Open the gates," and so on. Chapter 54, 12, 26, now 54, better write them down, is the song of Israel, the rejected bride who is now being reclaimed. "Sing, O barren one, who did not bear." Same idea is then repeated. "Break forth into singing and cry aloud, you who have not been in travail." End of lesson. A bit of poetry, a further note regarding the use of song, and now I'm almost to the limit of my expertise. I told you I wasn't too smart in this area, but at least we've started. So what I want to do with the remainder of our time is to examine more closely one of the most famous of Isaiah's lyric poems, or poems meant to be sung. A prophet is really no good unless he can communicate his message. And not just so people hear and understand, but that the weight of what is being shared stays with them. And what better way to do this than to put a song in people's hearts that they find themselves singing again and again? Use your imagination when you read a passage like Isaiah 5. The prophet begins, "Let me sing for my beloved a love song concerning his vineyard." Then, as you read the words, presume he's doing precisely that. "My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He digged it and cleared it of stones and planted it with choice vines. He built a watchtower in the midst of it and hewed out a wine vat in it, and he looked for it to yield grapes, but it yielded wild grapes. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge, I pray you," he sings, "between me and my vineyard. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done in it? When I look for it to yield grapes, why did it yield wild grapes? Now I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. I will remove its hedge, and it shall be devoured. I will break down its wall, and it shall be trampled down. I will make it a waste. It shall not be pruned or hoed, and briars and thorns shall grow up. I will also command the clouds that they rain no rain upon it." Conclusion. "For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel." Notice the repetition now. "And the men of Judah are her pleasant plantings. And he looked for justice, but behold, bloodshed." Again, "for righteousness, but behold, a cry." It's a powerful word, isn't it? In the 60s, the Peter, Paul, and Mary hit "Blowin' in the Wind" kind of became the theme song of the civil rights movement. I wonder if Isaiah's poignant Song of the Vineyard might not have played a similar role in 8th century B.C. Judah. Possibly the Lord even used it to keep alive the hope of revival that later was to be actualized under Hezekiah. Of course, I don't know for sure, but I rather suspect I'm not that far from the truth regarding what took place, because poetry and music sometimes can carry as much clout as a sermon. Did you catch Isaiah's single point in this, his musical message? God expects his hard work to result in a fruitful yield. Could hardly miss it, could you? God expects his hard work to result in a fruitful yield. Hey, Judah, Isaiah is asking on the Lord's behalf, after all Yahweh's invested in you, how come the wild grapes? There's no excuse for it, you know. Not one whatsoever. I wonder, do you think Isaiah was right? Were God's expectations fair? I ask because it seems to me maybe it's time for this nation to hear a similar song. America, America, when God shed his grace on thee, why so much sin now from sea to shining sea? What more could the Lord have done? And why these wild grapes year after year after year? In Isaiah 27, as revealed in an earlier visit, the prophet makes it clear that because of her great evil, the nation must undergo exile in Babylon, while the Lord destroys the incense altars and the asherim throughout Judah. None is to remain standing, quote, for this is a people without discernment. Therefore he who made them will not have compassion on them. He that formed them will show them no favor. Did you catch the parallelism? He who made them will not have compassion on them. He that formed them will show them no favor. But in chapter 27, we also find the prophet seeing far off that time when a great and future king will reign. And in the text, Isaiah returns briefly to his earlier Song of the Vineyard. Chapter 27, verses 2 through 6. The prophet is making sure the promise stays alive in the people's hearts. In that day, a pleasant vineyard. Sing of it. I, the Lord, am its keeper. Every moment I water it. Lest anyone harm it, I guard it night and day. I have no wrath. Would that I had thorns and briars to battle. I would set out against them. I would burn them up together. Or let them lay hold of my protection. Let them make peace with me. In the days to come, Jacob shall take root. Israel shall blossom and put forth shoots and fill the whole earth with fruit. Well, finally, Isaiah's vineyard songs are representative of individuals as well as nations. There's no one listening to me right now in whom God hasn't already made a pretty heavy investment. Because you can't argue with me, I won't press the point anymore. Instead, let's examine the payoff. What's the master's return look like? Have you taken deep roots, begun to put forth shoots? Or when the master looked for you to yield, did he find wild grapes? A person with no discernment. You no doubt remember Jesus' words, I chose you and appointed you that you should go and bear fruit and that your fruit should abide. Every branch of mine that bears no fruit, he takes away. By this my Father is glorified, that you bear much fruit and so prove to be my disciples.
Thank you, David, for once again powerfully illustrating how to preach this series of messages. As you can tell, these sermons are designed to assist the congregation in their spiritual formation. As you listened, I hope you could pick out every one of the 5 key elements of the Sermon Coach method of sermon development. As we continue through this series in future SermonCoach.com podcasts, not only do we hope you will use these as a very practical aid to honing your skills in using this method, but we also hope that this series will spark some creative ideas of your own. As always, we thank you for joining us for this time together. You found this SermonCoach.com podcast at our website, SermonCoach.com. That's sermon-coach.com. We invite you to browse through the rest of our website. We have resources there to help pastors create effective, life-transforming sermons. And we invite you to join us for our next SermonCoach.com podcast.